paused again. He'll do his not. He won't see that it's a better job with more prospects than me converting old cars for the ARP and spending my life in that garage. I mean, I've learned a lot, but I know I'm good at engines. I really am. Once I'm trained on aeroplanes, well, that's me. Set. Tom says that when this war is over, you watch, people will be going everywhere on aeroplanes, much more than they do now. I'll have a job for life. And I could go to other places. I could even go across the world. And Tom says they have engineers on some of the actual aeroplanes. They have engineers on bombers. I could work my way up. You want me to talk to your dad, don't you?
He listens to you, miss. He says you think the right things.
And what with my mom, you never know what's going to happen. All I know is that if it wasn't for Maggie Rowe, she would be back in the nut house. Bobby, come on. She's your mother and she's a good mother. You shouldn't talk about her like that.
I know, but it's just that sometimes I want to get away from home.
Look, don't tell your dad as soon as he walks into the house. Give them a chance to get settled. And if I were you, I would bide my time.
It's because of what's going on over there, isn't it? Billy's stuck there, I know he is.
Bobby, you've been working very hard lately. Get a good night's sleep and use that fine-tuned ear of yours to listen to your father and don't talk to him about this until he's rested, all right?
All right.
And I'll see what I can do about the cake. Bobby Beale laughed. I'll get my dad to give you a bell. Maisie replaced the receiver and sat down, leaning forward, her elbows on the table, her forehead resting on her hands.
Oh, Bobby, I wish you hadn't told me, she said aloud to the room.
Poor Billy.
Maisie kept the conversation short when Billy telephoned half an hour later. In the interim, she had started the case map and had been linking names, facts, dates, times, noting thoughts that occurred to her and questions to be answered. The diagram on paper resembled wires converging into a junction box. She now had the name of Billy's friend, Peter Sands, and Billy said he would get in touch and ask him if he could pop into the office. She reiterated that she only wanted to draw upon his expertise and would gladly remunerate him for his time. Billy did not mention Bobby, except to say he had been a good lad and clearly had been looked after while alone in the house. Doreen was home now and would return to Hampshire on Monday with Margaret Rose. The telephone rang.
"So that's where you are," said Priscilla Partridge. "Did you forget? You're supposed to be at a special ambulance driver practice this evening, and you've got 5 minutes to get here. Mr. Roach is about to blow a gasket, as two of the younger women are not here either, and he expected us experienced ladies to set an example. That was a rather strange experience, I must say. I was always the one being punished as an example to others when I was at school. We may be volunteers, but this is like being in the army."
"I'm leaving now," said Maisie as she grabbed her bag. "In fact, the doorbell has just rung and I think that's my transport. Thank goodness for the police."
"What?"
"Nothing. Tell Mr. Roach I'll be 10 minutes. Later, after she and Priscilla had managed to take an ambulance to Marble Arch and back in the dark, and then negotiated a derelict building looking for injured, more volunteers, and then taken them to the nearest hospital, the two women were given a lift home to Holland Park in the back of an ambulance. They stood outside Priscilla's mansion, which was a short walk from Maisie's flat. The whereabouts of Priscilla's eldest son seemed to consume her thoughts, along with worries about her middle and younger sons.
"Thank goodness Tarkin is minding his P's and Q's, that's all I can say. And I am so glad Tim is coming down to you. Douglas said that he needed work to get his back into. Serious man work, he said. On the farm or with your father. Tim should stop thinking all the time of all the things he's not doing and get on with the things he can. He's so argumentative. He's turned from my delightful second son into a little war machine into himself."
"He can come down tomorrow if you like. I plan to catch the train before lunch. My motor is at Chelstone, and I'm trying not to use it too much now anyway. Not fond of driving in the dark, and
I can't afford to waste my petrol coupons. Oh, Douglas has something lined up for Tim tomorrow. Another distraction. By the way, you did all right tonight, Maisie. The way you took that turn onto Oxford Street was quite amazing. I wonder if they deliberately put other vehicles right in the middle of the road to test us. After all, when we have a real emergency, there will be a lot in our way.
It was all the wood they scattered on the narrow alley up to the house. That was a test because there's obviously a point where we'll have to leave the ambulance and run and then bring the wounded to the ambulance and reverse out again.
God willing, we'll never have to run into any burning buildings, eh, Maisie? But according to Roach, we too outdid ourselves. Frankly, I think he's shocked that anyone over 30 has the stamina for this job. But we showed him, didn't we?
Maisie laughed and kissed Priscilla on the cheek. Tell Tim we're looking forward to seeing him, especially Anna. Oh, by the way, he has had measles, hasn't he?
Priscilla waved her hand. My boys have had everything, everything you can imagine a boy can get.
Later, as Maisie sat in her walled garden with a cup of tea and a sandwich, she gazed up at the outlines of barrage balloons obscuring the night sky. A darkness punctuated only by searchlights from a nearby anti-aircraft AK-AK battery scouring the heavens for possible Luftwaffe interlopers. And she wondered, then, how long the quiet would last. How long before Hitler's armies would draw even closer, their aircraft overhead raining down a blitzkrieg of terror. In Madrid, she had already seen what the Luftwaffe could inflict upon a people. Or would it all blow over? Would Britain capitulate to the approaching enemy coming closer and closer with every passing day? She went into the house, washed her plate, cup, saucer, and cutlery, and went to bed. Sleep did not come with ease, so instead she opened the blackout curtain and allowed herself to be lulled by the searchlights moving back and forth, cones of light against a midnight blue sky. At 9 o'clock the following morning, Maisie, Billy, and Peter Sands sat at the long table in Maisie's office.
"It's very good of you to come in to see us, Mr. Sands. I really appreciate your time."
"Oh, not to worry, Miss Stubbs. And call me Pete. It's a bit of a slow day, to tell you the truth. Now, if it was last week, it would have been another matter. But I'm putting the finishing touches to a job over in Russell Square."
He paused, sipped from the mug of tea Billy had passed to him, and looked at Maisie, then Billy.
"So, my mate here said you wanted to pick my brains?"
"Yes, Pete, I'm sure you can help us. We'd like to hear what you might know about Yates and Sons. They've landed a lucrative government contract for painting buildings on airfields across the country, and the emulsion, if you can call it that, is very viscous, has a strong vapour, and from what we understand already, it does the job it was designed for, which is to stop a fire from taking over if the airfield is attacked."
"I heard they pulled in a big one. Of course, that's not something that would come my way, being just me and one apprentice. Nice money, especially the way things are. I reckon that one job will keep them going throughout the war, and it'll mean their boys are out of it, what with government work being protected."
"Have you ever used anything like this emulsion? Do you know what they put in it?" asked Maisie.
The man shook his head.
"I've heard about paint like that, but not put a brush in it myself. But you know, what with the war, I reckon they're using new stuff and probably not tested, so they won't know how long it will last, that sort of thing. Which again means that Yates' lads will have jobs for as long as the war goes on. Ah, but let's hope it's not as long as the last one."
"Let's hope, mate," said Billy.
"One thing," Maisie interjected, "and it's a tricky question, Mr. Sands, but do you think Yates is on the up and up in his business affairs? Have you ever heard anything untoward or critical of his business practices?"
The man shrugged.
"Everyone's got to make a living, haven't they? Oh, Bill Yates only took the firm so far, but Mike Yates worked hard, put in the hours and made the connections, so it became a much bigger business. For our line of work, anyway.
But a growing concern like that means more mouths to feed, because no one likes laying off their workers, especially men they've apprenticed and trained up. I mean, it's not like they're packing sausages, is it? And it's not as if any bloke with a brush can just slap paint on walls. Well, it can, but you can always tell the cowboys in the trade.
He paused, rubbing his stubbled chin.
I wouldn't say Mike Yates has bad commercial practices, as far as I know, but he is a terrier. He finds out about new business, goes after the opportunities, and he keeps the customers over time. The minute his crew have finished the downstairs on a job over in Belgravia, then he's over there asking about the upper floors. For every customer, there's a record kept of what they've had done, and when. And he's in there as soon as he thinks a room might need another coat of paint. And he's a stickler for his men looking clean and tidy, all wearing spotless whites at the start of every week and every new job, and he'll check a work site to make sure they're leaving it in good order every day. But no getting away from it. If there's business out there, then Mike Yates is on it like a fly on a corpse.
Maisie and Billy exchanged glances. Then Maisie turned her attention back to the man seated between them. How would someone find out about a contract like this? Would the government have come to Mr. Yates? Or would he have his contacts?
Bloke like Mike Yates? It'll be a bit of both. He's big enough to be known, and on the other hand, the people he works for are your well-heeled lot, on drinking terms with knobs in high places. And you've got to remember, like I said, a job like that won't come to a one-man band like me, or even a cartload of us. It goes to a business big enough to get the job done. And knowing Mike, he would make sure the customer gets the price they want. But so does he. His boys would be putting away a pretty penny too. I would imagine someone from the government arranged all the lodgings and that sort of thing. Mike Yates wouldn't take that on.
Do you think Mr. Yates would do or say anything if he thought the emulsion were dangerous? Asked Maisie.
I think that unless someone dropped dead in front of him, he would ignore it, hoping that nothing happened that he had to attend to while he was counting the money.
He paused, looking at his hands, shrugged and brought his gaze back to Maisie.
And to tell you the truth, Miss Stubbs, any of us would do the same thing. If I'm to be perfectly honest with you, we all need work, and we've all had hard times, especially since the last war. No one can afford to look a gift horse in the mouth.
Maisie nodded. Yes, you're right.
And who knows what was causing the lad to have these headaches. Might have been something to do with the company he was keeping. He could have been smoking and not been used to it, or trying to keep up with the old allowance at the pub. Perhaps that's why he ended up like he did. Billy told me about the railway line.
Billy was about to speak. Maisie heard him start.
But Pete, when Sands continued, they always say, though, to follow the money, don't they? Which is why you're asking me these questions about Yates, but there's more to the money than where the boy worked.
What do you mean, mate? Asked Billy.
Ever seen Phil Coombs when he gets a chance to go out? I mean, you think he doesn't see the sky, but for his walk down the road to the calf every morning. But I've seen him go out dressed up, suit and all. Not all the time, but every now and again. And they've got the telephone. Never known the brewery to do that for a publican. So he must be special.
He scratched his head and put his cap back on.
It's not always the big things you notice. They don't have a motor car, and Phil and Sally Coombs aren't flash. But there are a lot of little things.
To be fair, Mr. Coombs works very hard, and they're very friendly, and that brings in a lot of custom, offered Maisie.
So do I work hard, and I'm friendly. Got to be, haven't you? Replied Sands. But my daughter doesn't have a new pair of shoes every couple of months, and my wife, her hair done regular as clockwork. Sally Coombs might look a bit dowdy at times, but she can get dolled up when she wants to. Her handbags don't come cheap, and they buy quality. Now, Phil is doing very well, and it's coming from somewhere.
Maisie came to her feet at the same time as Sands. Billy pushed back his chair and made his way to the door. Thank you, Mr. Sands. She pressed 5 shillings into his palm with her handshake. Your time is appreciated.
I hope I didn't drag you away from your work this morning. Sands touched the peak of his cap.
Much obliged, Miss Dobbs. And no, it's all right. Like I said, I'm only over in Russell Square. Mind you, I hope my apprentice hasn't painted the lamps by the time I get back.
I'll see you out to the street, mate, said Billy, holding open the door. As the door closed behind the men, their voices muffled as they made their way downstairs to the front door, Maisie walked to the window overlooking Fitzroy Square. She watched as Billy shook hands with Pete Sands, and the painter and decorator walked away in the direction of Warren Street. As she was turning away from the window, Maisie glanced back. A black motor car parked on Conway Street. She moved to one side, so that she might see without being seen. For it was as if the driver, silhouetted against light filtering into the vehicle, were looking straight at her. Chapter 7 Maisie and Billy sat in silence in front of the case map, looking at the highways and byways of colour expressing each thought and idea that had come to them, while considering the case of Joe Coombs. Though the exercise seemed at that point to be getting them nowhere.
So, the Air Force girl didn't call back, did she?
She might have, but I had to rush off yesterday evening, ambulance practice, and I was late because it had completely slipped my mind.
They won't strike you off. You're a volunteer. Apparently they've had to give quite a few of the employed ones their cards and send them back down to the labour exchange.
They'll get their jobs back, and it won't be long, I shouldn't wonder.
I thought the same thing.
Billy looked down at his hands, rubbing the palm of the right up and down across the knuckles of the left. Everyone holding up at home? Asked Maisie.
I'm amazed, really, said Billy. They're keeping their chins up, especially Doreen. She said it won't get our Billy back any sooner if we all sit around in the state. I don't like what I'm reading in the papers, though. They say there's going to be a service at Westminster Abbey on Sunday. Prayers for the safety of our boys over there. I'm not one for all that, but I reckon it won't hurt. So we'll probably come up for it and put our hands together with the rest of them. People say it will be packed.
Maisie nodded, thoughtful, as she picked up a thick red crayon from the table. Money. Money and war. There's Yates making money out of the war, and so many others who are doing well out of something terrible, though I don't begrudge people the opportunity to put more cash in their pockets.
My mate, who works over at Fleet Street, reckons that crime has gone up, and everyone thought it would go down, what with us being at war. And it's not only the criminals that are doing well. Look at the landlords who are putting up those workers from Yates. They're raking it in. And then there's the fact that prices have gone up on a lot of your basic foods, added Billy. Mind you, they went up when war was declared, then they came down when nothing much happened, and now they're going up again. No wonder that new tenant down in the basement is growing tomatoes out the back. He'll have a cow in there next. You watch. We can talk him up for a pint of milk.
Maisie laughed, tapping the case map. You know, apparently there's money in Hampshire, said Maisie. I've heard the Bank of England has moved its operations there for the duration, and it's also where the paper supplier is located.
Do you think it's got anything to do with this?
Asked Billy. Maisie was thoughtful, drawing her attention from Billy and the case map to the window in the blue sky beyond. You know, when I first started working for Maurice, I would try to put my discovered information on a given case into a box. Not a literal box with six sides, but I would keep notes. And I'd ask myself if the nugget I'd collected was irrelevant, or if it was a distraction. Was it something just to be aware of? Could it be described as important? Finally, I put whatever I'd discovered into the categories of significant, crucial, or essential, whatever name I'd come up with. And I would go back to the information daily and ask myself if it still belonged in that particular box.
It helped me to sort through what I'd gathered because I realized I'd been treating everything as really crucial and spent a lot of time like a dog chasing its tail and not always managing evidence very well. It helped me to grow what Maurice termed my intuitive response, though I'm not sure he quite approved of my method. She smiled, remembering the errors of her early days as an investigator. So at first, when I considered the information about how and where money was printed, and the coincidental relocation of the Bank of England to the same area as Joe Coombs's lodgings, I labelled it a distraction, something that would take time we don't have and nothing much in return. Now I think it's important. Not crucial or essential, but important. Something to keep, up our sleeves, something that might prove to be useful. She brought her attention back to Billy. I always thought the Bank of England's printing works was over on Luke Street.
Yeah, but perhaps not everyone knows that. After all, I heard the works down there in Hampshire is where money is printed for all over the world, and that sounds important enough to me.
Billy leaned toward the table, resting his chin on closed fists, placed one on top of the other. He studied the map.
I don't know about this headache business. I mean, I reckon young Joe Coombs had them all right, the headaches, but I don't think that's what killed him. Not what made him end up dead on a railway line.
No, neither do I. Maisie scraped back her chair and walked to the window. She looked down at the makeshift market garden in the yard, noticing a man's cardigan draped over a wooden chair. She realized that, apart from the well-tended flowers and vegetables, this was the first sign she had seen of whoever lived in the basement flat. She turned back to Billy.
Right, this is what we do next, and we're limited by the fact that it's a Friday, but Phil and Sally are at the pub.
She looked at her watch.
I'll catch the later train now, so I'll make a quick call to Chelstone and we'll go round to the Prince. I'm sure Vivian will not be at work in the circumstances, and the other son, Archie, might have come home to be with his family. It's a good time to get them together.
Or perhaps not, what with them grieving.
They know I've tried to do the best for them, and will be there just as neighbours, friends, who know what they've lost.
Do you think they're involved
in the death of their son? I don't think any parent would knowingly risk the life of their child. You wouldn't, would you?
She reached for the telephone receiver.
But perhaps there's something amiss in that family, and we both know that involvement in a crime can be the result of something seemingly benign.
She began to dial.
Or the family may have no connection to Joe's death whatsoever. Anyway, let me talk to Brenda, and then we'll leave.
Vivian Coombs looked as if she had slept in her clothes, a dress that was crumpled, stockings twisted so the seams were askew, and a cardigan pulled around her to ward off a chill that no one else would feel on a warm day in late spring. Maisie thought her fine, fair hair had not seen a brush that morning, and she wore no shoes. A ladder had started to run from her toe to her ankle, and she had stopped its progress with a dab of red nail enamel. The landlord's daughter was usually a well-turned-out young woman, today standing in the doorway at the side of the pub. She resembled a slattern.
"Oh, Vivian, I am so terribly sorry," said Maisie as she held out her arms. Vivian Coombs all but fell into her embrace, weeping.
Maisie nodded, a sign for Billy to go up to the family rooms.
"How are you bearing up, Vivian? I know you and Joe were so very close," said Maisie.
"He was my little brother, and he was so innocent. Not like some of them. Not like other boys. He was good, Miss Dobbs."
"I know. I know. Is Archie here?"
Vivian stepped back, though remained close to Maisie as if she needed a strength not present among her family.
"He's been round. He didn't stay, though. Said he had to get back to work."
She looked at Maisie and swept the back of her hand across her forehead,
her pale blue eyes veined as they filled with tears once more.
I mean, I'm supposed to be at work, and I've got important work, especially now, what with everything happening over there in France. But my supervisor let me have the day off, for compassionate reasons. I hate Archie sometimes. Really, I do.
No, you don't. You're just grieving, and nothing will seem right for a long time. And perhaps it was too much for him. People deal with these things in different ways, and perhaps getting back to work is his way of trying to come to terms with Joe's passing.
It's all he ever does, work. Can't come to see us because of work. Work, work, work. And no one works that hard. Not so they can't come to see their family.
Let's go up. I wanted to see if there was anything I could do for you all, said Maisie. Vivian led the way upstairs, where a landing opened to several rooms. To the left, a kitchen, then a sitting room, followed by the bathroom. The door of one bedroom was open, and pinned on the walls were staged photographs of film stars, Alan Ladd being the most favoured. Scarves were draped over the dressing-table mirror, and several library books perched next to a hairbrush. Two additional doors to the right of the stairs were closed, though Maisie assumed they led to bedrooms. In the kitchen, Phil Coombs and Billy sat at the table, while Sally Coombs stood at the stove, watching the kettle as it came to the boil.
"Nice of you to come back, Miss Dobbs," said Coombs. "Hey, isn't it so?"
he continued, turning to his wife. Maisie stepped away from Vivian and moved to Sally Coombs's side. "I am so sorry, Mrs. Coombs. Yesterday was very official with the police here. I wanted to come back to see how you're all faring, and if there's anything I can do." Sally Coombs turned to Maisie, her loss writ large in a raw desolation reflected in her eyes, and in the grey skin drawn across her cheekbones. Her hands shook as she reached for the kettle.
"Let me," said Maisie.
"We've fair drunk London out of tea," said Phil Coombs. "I'm supposed to be opening up today, but I can't. Can't face people. Can't face the looks, the questions, if they bother to ask. People are probably too frightened."
He looked at Maisie, who had made the pot of tea, and was now setting clean cups on the draining board, ready to pour.
"I'm grateful to you, Miss Dobbs. We might never have known if you hadn't been down there trying to find Joe."
"And thank you for going down, you know, to identify him. We couldn't have done it. None of us," added his wife, who had taken a seat between her daughter and husband.
"Archie could have," said Vivian. "I can see him now saying, 'Yeah, that's my brother. Now that's done, I'm off down the pub.' I can hear him now," said Vivian.
"Vivian, that's not fair. Your brother is a good young man. We brought you all up the same. He just takes it all in a different way."
The girl's mother held up a finger to make a point.
"You would do well to remember that, and remember who looks after you."
Vivian scraped back her chair and left the kitchen, running along the landing to her room and slamming the door behind her. Coombs rubbed his forehead as his wife began weeping again.
"It's been like this since the news came. I mean, aren't we all supposed to pull together? I've got two at loggerheads, and we can't seem to get ourselves going, and we've got a funeral to get sorted out."
Billy nodded to Maisie and took her place to pour the tea. Maisie sat down and reached across to lay a hand on Coombs's forearm. There is no path set for this kind of shock, and for the grief that attends such terrible news. Vivian is in so much distress over losing her brother. That horror inside has to find a way out, so she's very, very angry. We all have a different way of dealing with loss, and sometimes our ways clash. She took a breath, knowing her words would cause more pain, but had to be given voice. "You don't have to rush to plan the funeral.
Joe won't be released to you for burial yet. They have more work to do trying to find out what might have been ailing him.
Do you think he jumped? Asked Coombs. Do you think it was all this boys will be boys business? And if he was alone, why wasn't he with the other blokes?
Maisie nodded to acknowledge Billy as he placed cups of tea in front of each of them, and then took a seat at the table. She had noticed he had remained very quiet.
I think the police have good reason to think he was a victim of his own ebullience on the night he died. However,
she modulated her speech, choosing her words with care.
However, I think the question of how Joe spent the past couple of weeks should be answered.
The police aren't going to do any of that answering, though, are they?
Said Sally Coombs.
That detective, what was his name, Caldwell, he said the coroner would likely say it was either accidental death or death by misadventure.
Detective Chief Inspector Caldwell was being honest about what was discovered, and the conclusions of the pathologist at the scene. They will look very carefully at how Joe was found. Please trust that they are continuing to consider each small mite of evidence they can find to discover what lies behind Joe's death. She looked from Phil to Sally Coombs, who were both leaning toward her, as if she had the answers to every one of their questions.
And I want to assure you that I will not cease to investigate Joe's death myself. I knew Joe, saw him grow up here, and I want to find out the truth of what was behind the accident that led to you losing him.
They finished their tea in an almost whispered quiet, with Maisie steering the conversation to Joe's childhood so that they might remember their son as he was and not how they might imagine him to have been at the point of his death. Maisie and Billy took their leave, receiving thanks from the pub landlord and his wife, and Maisie in turn asked them to say goodbye to Vivian and to tell her that she was being held in their thoughts. Billy did not speak until they reached the front door leading up to the office, whereupon he turned to look around at the square.
"What is it, Billy? What do you want to say?"
asked Maisie.
"All right, it's like this. The carpet is an inch thick on those stairs, and them cups and saucers, and the teapot, sugar bowl, and jug were bone china. Matching, at that. And did you see the watch on Phil's wrist? All very nice."
Maisie waited, for she knew Billy had more to get off his chest.
"I feel really, really bad for them, miss, because that Joe was a young diamond of a lad. And Viv is a good girl, even if she does have a bit of the Sarah Bernhardts about her. But I still think something's not right, and I know where to start."
"The older son?" Billy nodded. "Good, because I was going to ask you to make a point of going over to see him. He works in Sydenham, easy to get to on your way home, isn't it?"
"Just a bit out my way, but consider it as good as done," said Billy.
"One thing, though," added Maisie. "Remember, he's grieving too, and I meant what I said. Everyone's different. We've both seen it before. When Brenda received bad news about her sister, she went out and cleaned all the windows like a demon. That could be Joe's older brother. Work could be balm for his aching soul. And it wouldn't surprise me if his sister's dramatic bent didn't irritate him a bit."
"Would me," said Billy.
"So go easy on him.
You still think something's amiss, though, don't you?"
"I do," said Maisie. "But I don't want to scare anyone either. Now, I must be getting along, or I'll miss my train."
"One more thing, miss."
"Yes?"
"What shall we do about that bloke in the black motor car over there?"
Maisie reached into her handbag for her keys.
"I thought I'd wait to see which one of us he follows. And if it's you, Billy, I want you to go straight home. Your family has too much worry to risk any more problems at the moment."
From the floor-to-ceiling windows at the front of the office, Maisie watched the vehicle on the other side of the square and sighed. Yes, she was tempted to end her own speculation, walk across to Conway Street and rap on the window. But at the same time, she too had much to lose. That thought reminded her of an overdue telephone call she had promised to make. She turned away from the window, and just as she was about to reach for the receiver, the telephone began to ring. She picked up the black Bakelite receiver and recited the number.
"Is that Miss Maisie Dobbs? Is she there?"
The voice on the line was that of a young woman, a voice lacking the tone of maturity, but with more resonance than that of a schoolgirl. Maisie would have put her at 21 or 22 years of age.
"I'd like to speak to her, please."
"Yes, this is Maisie Dobbs. Who's speaking?"
"Oh, at last. I've reached you. I thought it would go on ringing for ages, and I have so little time when I can get to the telephone box. My name's Sylvia Preston, leading aircrafts woman Preston, WAAF. You should have received a message. I'd called before."
"Yes, I did, Miss Preston, but I thought it best not to call back, as I have no idea of your shift times."
"I'm glad you didn't, after that first telephone call. That nosy mare of a landlady can't keep anything to herself, and she's half-cut most of the time. I'm happy to have moved out, though I sometimes wonder if I haven't gone from the fat into the fire."
"Oh, dear," said Maisie.
"It's all right, really. This one's harmless, to a point. But about Joey Coombs, oh, heck."
Maisie heard the woman exclaim when the pip sounded, though she was soon back on the line, having inserted more coins to continue the call.
"I can telephone you back," said Maisie. "Give me your number."
Sylvia Preston read out the number and hung up. Maisie dialed and heard one ring before the WAAF answered.
"Yes, thank you."
She sounded breathless.
"Are you all right?" asked Maisie. "You're not in any danger."
"I'm in danger every day."
"But not the sort you mean?"
The young woman gave a half laugh, almost a snort.
"I ran to get to the telephone, and now I'm trying not to breathe in for the terrible smell in here. I don't know why people have to do some of the things they do in a telephone box. Anyway, let me tell you what I think you should know."
"Go on," said Maisie.
"I heard you talking to the landlady when you came down. She didn't quite tell you everything. There were two men keen to see Joe. Both of them turned out very well indeed, looking like they were in the pictures. Not in uniform, but not everyone is, though they both looked like they should be. One was about my age, I would imagine, 21, 22, something like that, and the other was older, 30s. He reminded me of my brother, who's 36. I know, don't ask about the age difference between us. I reckon my mum kept away from my dad for 15 years after the terrible time she had when my brother was born."
Maisie smiled and prompted Preston.
"But there must have been something a bit off for you to notice them. What didn't you like?"
"I didn't like the way they spoke to him. I couldn't hear the words, but as they walked a little way down the road, I didn't like the tone. I could hear them. Friendly enough, first of all. They called him Joe, so they knew him. Well, the younger one did. The other one was more officious, I would say. Nice enough, handing out the ciggies. Joe shook his head. He was a good boy. Really, he was. Shouldn't have been away from home, I reckon. Then I couldn't hear anything, but I could see. And Joe just kept shaking his head. And then the younger one got him by the arm. You know, grabbed his upper arm and turned toward him. I don't know what he said, but it looked like Joe was scared. He held his head down as if he didn't want to look up into their faces."
"Did he go off with them?"
"No, he didn't. They had a motor car, though. I saw them get into it. But here's what happened. Another one of the painters, Freddie Mays, came along in the van and stopped alongside them. I can't be sure, but I think he knew them. Well, he knew the older one. The younger man was in the black motor car already, and Joe got into the van as if it had been a life raft come to save him. I couldn't make out his face.
perhaps you can see these things by the way people move. He clamoured in that van, sharpish.
Then, promoted Maisie.
Then the van drove off, and so did the motor car. The motor car went out on Winchester Road, and the van in another direction. I don't know which airfield they were at that day.
There was a pause on the line before Preston continued.
That's about it, Miss Dobbs. As I said, our illustrious landlady didn't tell you quite everything.
Thank you, Mrs. Preston, said Maisie. I appreciate you getting in touch very much indeed.
Well, I had to. We all liked Joe, us girls. He took our teasing in good heart. But he was a good boy.
She paused, and Maisie thought she heard her begin to weep. Are you all right, Sylvia?
I just think it's terrible that he's missing, that he's gone off somewhere, probably to get away from those blokes, if I know anything. Do you think you'll find him?
Maisie drew breath and closed her eyes. Giving news of a death was never straightforward. The words caught in her heart and in her throat. I'm so sorry, Sylvia. Joe's body was found a few days ago. He's dead, I'm afraid. There was silence on the line, after several seconds punctuated by a sniff and a cough.
It wasn't an accident, was it?
Said Preston, her words stumbling out as she sobbed.
I tell you, Joe was scared, Miss Dobbs. I don't know what he was scared of, but he had fear written all over him during that last week I saw him.
Would you know those men again? Asked Maisie.
The younger one, probably, but I know how easy it is to make mistakes, so I would have to be careful.
You're to be commended for your reticence, Sylvia, and before Maisie could say more, Preston broke in.
I've just had enough of death and bodies. Really, I have.
What do you mean?
My job. Look, sorry, I'm not supposed to talk about it.
I can be trusted if you want to get something off your chest. Silence again, and more sniffing.
I'm a driver, Miss Dobbs. They taught me to drive, and I thought I would be driving the officers up and down to London and out to other airfields, that sort of thing, but you know what I do. I drive an ambulance.
An ambulance? For practice drills?
I suppose you could say that, but the death is real.
You're going to have to explain that to me, Sylvia. I'm not quite following you.
They're training the army to parachute. All these boys coming down in big lorries so they can practice parachuting. They're taking on Germans over there. I don't know when they think they're going to do that, what with everyone talking about an invasion. But the army has already started them practicing at their barracks, jumping off walls so they know how to land. Then they bring them here to jump from aircraft. They go up over Salisbury Plain, that's one place. We wait in the ambulances as they come down. We don't pick up many injured. If you land wrong, you're dead. Easy as that. If I get one with a sprained ankle, or a broken leg, or a collarbone, or what have you, I feel as if I've been let off light. Most of the time I'm with another girl loading up dead lads whose legs have gone right up through their bodies, or they're completely smashed up. That's my job. One time I had to drive back across Salisbury Plain in the dark on my own with 6 dead boys in the back of my ambulance so no one would see. No one would know. And I tell you, I don't think aeroplanes were invented for people to suddenly get up off their seat and jump out of a door. But that's me.
I am so very sorry, Sylvia, said Maisie. I had no idea.
Oh, no one has any idea. And to think I was pleased to be a driver, working outside on the move, and none of this stuck indoors doing meteorology or typing up reports for the brass. Now I drive a death wagon, that's how it feels.
She paused, drawing breath before continuing.
You won't tell anyone, will you?
I promise, Sylvia. Right. I've got to go now. Thank you very... Maisie was expressing gratitude to the continuous hum of the disconnected call. When she had raised her head from her hands, with the image of young women lifting the terribly damaged bodies of equally young men still in her mind's eye, Maisie reached for the telephone receiver and dialed a number she knew by heart. A man answered, a clerk to the solicitor she was seeking. "Hello, Anthony. Is Mr. Klein there, please?"
"Yes, your ladyship. I will tell him you're waiting. One moment, please."
There was silence on the line, and then a series of clicks before the measured tones of her solicitor echoed down the line.
"Maisie, how lovely to hear from you. It's about time we had a chat about your affairs. I'm afraid, what with the war, I am concerned with regard to the properties in France. However,
I beg your pardon, Mr. Klein. It's so impolite of me to interrupt, but I would like to speak to you about Anna."
"Ah, yes. I have held back, but if you wish, I will take your instructions to find a good family for her."
"Mr. Klein, I... She felt herself falter. "Mr. Klein, I think I..."
"We'd better meet, Maisie. I believe I understand completely. Are you about to leave town, or can you come to my office?"
"I'm catching a later train today. I dare say Anna is resting in any case. She has measles."
"Is she recovering?"
"I'm assured she is on the mend."
"Good. Can you be here within the hour?"
"I'm leaving now."
"Excellent. I will have a series of papers for you to go over and a list of documents required. Thank goodness the law hasn't changed. It was on the books, you know, but the war got in the way. Anyway, we can make a start."
"Thank you, Mr. Klein."
"I told you long ago, Maisie, you may call me Bernard."
"Indeed, but old habits die hard." The black motor car was still parked on Conway Street, though upon closer inspection, Maisie realized it wasn't completely black, but had a dark bottle green contrasting paint along the sides. She turned from the front window and crossed the office to the back window overlooking the yard below. There was a tall but narrow gate forming a rear exit to the alley, though probably not used. Terracotta pot had been placed in front, filled with flowering plants. She gathered her handbag and briefcase, locked the door as she departed the office, and made her way down the stairs. But instead of leaving by the front door, she turned left at the end of the staircase and stepped across to a plain door with no number or name alongside. With her knuckle, she rapped on the panelled door. There was no answer. She closed her eyes, whispering, "Please come, please come." She rapped again and again. It was as she turned to leave that she heard the door being unlocked and a chain drawn back. The man before her was, she thought, a few years older than herself, of taller than average height. He wore dark trousers, a clean, white, collarless shirt, and an unbuttoned waistcoat. He leaned on a walking stick, and when she looked into his face, she saw a scar running from his left cheekbone down to an uneven jaw. At one glance, it was as if she knew everything about him.
"What do you want?"
asked the man. Maisie did not look away when her eyes met his. "My name is Maisie Dobbs. I work in the office above, and I wonder, would you be so kind as to allow me to leave by your back gate? I suppose it leads into the alley, am I right? I'll set the plants aside and we'll move them back again when I return, but I would be very much obliged if you could help me." The man looked at her for a period of time, perhaps only a second or two, though it seemed as if he would never respond to her request. He inclined his head, stepped back, and held out his hand for her to enter.
"Of course, please come in. And I apologize for taking so long to answer your knock. I usually use the entrance at the front, so was taken aback to hear someone at this door. Follow me."
The man led the way from the narrow landing and two short flights of stairs into a sitting room, which she thought was probably also the bedroom. He proceeded through to a scullery and out into the yard. She was still surprised by the neat order of the flat when she emerged into the small yard, and realized her view from above did not do justice to the abundance of color the man had created.
"Oh, my, this is just beautiful, so small and so perfect, Mr. Forgive me, I don't know your name."
"I never told you."
He held out his hand.
"Walter Miles."
"Thank you, Mr. Miles." Maisie took the outstretched hand and returned his smile.
"Come on, let's get you on your way."
Miles stepped across the flagstones and, with Maisie's assistance, began to move terracotta pots away from the gate.
"The bolt is a bit rusty, but I've moved it before."
He pulled on the bolt, and after some effort, it gave, shooting back and releasing the gate, which he drew back and held open.
"I can't thank you enough," said Maisie.
"It was my pleasure, Miss Dobbs. The motor car has been out there for hours now, so be on your way before he realizes you've left and starts tootling down Tottenham Court Road, looking for you."
Maisie was about to open her mouth when the man shook his head.
"Go now."
And as she ran down the alley and out onto Tottenham Court Road toward Good Street Station, Maisie could not help but wonder about Walter Miles. She had never seen him before, never noticed him coming or going. In fact, she assumed an elderly lady lived in the downstairs flat. Yet there was something familiar about him, and she knew very well the cause of his disfigurement. Wherever she went in this time of war, there was always a reminder of the last, even if it was only the sight of Billy wincing as he stood up from his desk. She reflected upon her conversation with Sylvia Preston, and the terrible job assigned to her. And she wondered how another generation of men and women in years to come would have to fight a different battle every single day, a battle against a time that would not fail to mark them, inside and out, and would come back to haunt them at moments when they least expected it. But now there was one victim of the war she would do her level best to ensure would have only joyful memories to look back upon in the years to come. After leaving the underground station at Holborn, she all but ran to the offices of Bernard Klein. Chapter 8. Maisie arrived at Chelstone later than she had hoped on Friday. Her train pulled into the sidings several times to allow other trains to pass, and the journey was longer than usual, with a change at Paddock Wood instead of Tunbridge. She asked a station guard why there was a diversion, and was informed it was due to extra trains coming up from the coast. Maisie's father and stepmother were sitting at the kitchen table when Maisie entered the house.
"Maisie, did you walk all the way from the station? You should have said. I would have met you, walked back with you."
"Not to worry, Dad."
She kissed him on the cheek, moving to her stepmother's side for the same greeting.
"How's Anna? Is she feeling better?"
"I was just going to take up some warm milk for her. It's on the side there, cooling. She's had such a sore throat," said Brenda.
"I'll take it up, then."
Maisie slipped off her jacket and placed it over the back of a chair. She turned toward the draining board, where the red china mug filled with hot milk had been left to cool. Maisie took a spoon from the drawer, skimmed the skin from the top of the milk, and placed the mug on a saucer.
"Is her honey already in, Brenda?"
"Oh, yes. Never forget the little woman's honey."
Maisie smiled as she left the kitchen and made her way upstairs. The door to Anna's room was ajar, so before stepping in, Maisie peered around. The child was awake, lying on her side and looking deep into the eyes of Emma, the orphaned Alsatian Maisie had rescued following the untimely death of the dog's owner. Emma's chin was resting on the counterpane, while Anna was running her fingers through the dog's ruff. But Anna was yawning, her eyelids growing heavy. "I think it's time for a little girl called Anna to have her milk and go to sleep," said Maisie. Anna turned and held out her arms to Maisie.
"Auntie Maisie! Auntie Maisie, I've still got measles."
Emma wagged her tail and came to Maisie, who patted her in greeting and pointed to the rug at the side of the bed. The dog turned and lay down, nose between paws, watching her young mistress. "Here you are." Maisie held her palm under the cup while Anna lifted it to her lips and drank the milk in just a few gulps. "Someone was thirsty," said Maisie as she took the cup with one hand and placed the fingers of the other to the child's forehead to feel her temperature. "How are you feeling now, my love?" Anna shrugged.
"I think I'm getting better, but Auntie Brenda says I have to stay in bed for a bit longer. Emma said so too. She likes to sleep here."
"Emma said so?"
"Yes, she told me this morning that we should stay in bed another 2 days to catch up on our sleep and be strong for Lady when I can ride again."
"Well, I think Emma's quite right. She's a very intelligent dog." Maisie stood up and placed the cup on a wicker side table. "Would you like me to read a story?" Anna nodded. "Just for 5 minutes, then I'll tuck you in. You've got a special visitor coming tomorrow."
"Who?"
said Anna, giggling already. Maisie was pleased to see the girl in good heart, in spite of her appearance, dark blue smudges under her eyes, flushed cheeks and scabby spots on her face and hands. "Your favourite young man, Tim."
"Tim! Tim's coming!"
"Yes, Tim's coming tomorrow." The child looked at her dog, then at Maisie.
"Emma says we will be ready to get up tomorrow. We're both over the measles."
Maisie laughed and reached for Anna, feeling the comfort of the small body pressing into hers. "I didn't know dogs could get measles."
"Oh, they can,"
said Anna.
"Emma said she had measles when she was a puppy, but she's felt a bit bad since I've got them."
Maisie looked down at the dog, who had lifted her head as if to check her young charge. "Well, let's see how you're both feeling tomorrow. Now, how about that story?" Anna gave Maisie one more squeeze and then lay back. Maisie reached toward a small pile of books on the wicker table, selected one in particular, and began to read. They were not railway children to begin with. I don't suppose they had ever thought about railways. Within just a few pages, Anna's breathing had become soft. Emma stood up, stretched, turned on the rug 3 times, and then settled down in a comfortable crescent, giving a contented low growl as she, too, fell asleep. Maisie replaced the book on the table, picked up the empty cup, and leaned over the child, brushed her jet-black hair from her forehead, and kissed her soft skin before leaving the room.
"She go down all right?" said Brenda, standing up to go to the stove as Maisie entered the kitchen.
"She perked up a bit, especially when I told her that Tim was coming tomorrow, but I think she needs another day or two in bed. We'll see." Brenda pulled a plate from the oven.
"There's some shepherd's pie warmed up, love, and I put on a few vegetables for you while you were up there with Anna. I bet you haven't eaten all day."
"Oh, lovely, thank you, Brenda. Just what the doctor ordered," said Maisie. She took a seat as Brenda placed the plate in front of her, but as she picked up her knife and fork, she looked across at her father, who was regarding her without speaking. "What is it, Dad?"
"Did you see your Mr. Klein?"
Maisie nodded.
"And he's going to help find a good family for the little nipper."
Maisie pressed her lips together as she faced her father, meeting his eyes with her own direct gaze. "Yes. Yes, he's going to help settle her." The following morning, after Maisie had helped Anna bathe and then dabbed calamine lotion onto the rash that dotted her back, torso, arms and face, the child asked if she could lie on top of the bed in her best dress, if she had to remain upstairs, rather than wear her nightgown.
"Oh, love, you still have lots of spots and they won't get better if you wear your ordinary clothes.
But what if you put on a fresh nightie, and you can wear your new blue cardigan over the top?" Anna seemed crestfallen, but Maisie knew she was a tractable child, not given to tantrums.
"That's a good idea," said Anna.
she began to smile.
Then, if I'm in bed, Tim won't know I don't have my proper clothes on, will he?
No, he won't. He'll think you're a big, strong girl. Now then, let me see your tongue. Open wide. Maisie looked into the child's mouth to check the back of her throat, searching for the inflammation that accompanied measles. That looks a lot better. Do you want to come down?